we'll cut that bit out if it turns out to be untrue. Carry on. But
oh, no, I think I'm wrong about that.
Fake news. Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton. With me today is Andy.
Hey, hey, hey.
And Duncan.
Hello.
It's our usual episode about the end of the season. This is the spring 2026 anime season. I personally watched a lot of shows, several of them gay. several of them could have been gayer. We'll talk about that.
I managed to get one show watched in completion. and how gay was it
in honor of Pride Month?
It wasn't that gay. There's a little bit of Yuri bait in there, but like mostly not that gay.
Yeah. Well, speaking of speaking of Pride, yeah. Speaking of performing, we have two interlinked shows, interlinked in terms of thematic preoccupation and directorial ambition. We mentioned both of these at the beginning of the season and in the middle of the season, and now it's the end of the season. We're going back to the old way where we talk about the same show 8 times in a row.
I mean, yes, we're guilty. We've definitely talked too much about 100 scenes of Aojima, and we've definitely talked too much about Kamen Naboto and Fully Blossoms When Drunk, but we did that with good reason. That reason was that one of them, at least, really, fully, you could say, exceeded our expectations.
It starts out as a show that's just about, you know, how fun it is to drink with friends, and it becomes about how as you get close to people, your insecurities flare up, and it becomes harder and harder to have the easy, intimate moments that brought you together in the first place. But it's still worth hanging out with people and drinking, even if there's more and more burdens surrounding you.
It's hard to play favorites.
Is it?
Overall, this is the show which brought me most joy this season. Like, I don't know if it was, you could call it the best in any objective way, but it's just when it did its little flourishes, I just really enjoyed it. And it's, I think I went into it expecting it to be sort of like a typical cute girls doing cute things, but just slightly aged up because of the subject matter. But I think it's generally sort of had a bit more depth than that.
Yeah.
And as you say, like, it's like main preoccupation is like this idea of the journey between not knowing someone and being intimate with them. And like, I've heard it in a podcast I listened to, that like what makes a good pub bar is that could any a lad or lady there imagine pulling, like can
sorry, that's why you go to bars. I think the age of pulling in a bar.
Andy, do you want to interrupt or do you want me to explain why it's important? It's like you have his rationale was that a good pub layout is a mix of intimate and public, and that you can sort of walk in as a stranger and walk out as friends. This idea that a place where you have the perfect environment to get to know someone, like you should be able to hear the sort of murmurs of other people talking, but you shouldn't be able to hear their words. It should be the sort of place where you can imagine going from not knowing someone to knowing someone. And alcohol obviously has its role in that. And like, there's a preoccupation in both in a boat in the show and with Cameron a boat in the character of how you bridge that divide. Like, I think someone on Anime News Network called it a show which has a lot of longing in it, and I don't think I disagree.
Yeah, one of my weaker aspects as a critic is that I tend to pay attention to the writing, and I do think Kamina Botan is wonderfully read, but in terms of building a like directorial and cinematographic and aural environment where you have these the writing supported is also one of the strengths. Oftentimes doing homage to old movies and having long periods of silence punctuated by often diegetic music and often the emptiness of the frame, the quietness of the interaction, the fact that like one of the weird things about alcohol as a social lubricant is when you're drinking, you're not talking. And so we have these bursts of conversation, then we have these long moments where they're just forced to coexist because they have to drink the beer they ordered. And there's that one scene where someone wants to wander off and the little bossy girl is like, no, I just got my beer. I'm sitting here. Like, you can you can go off. I'm not moving. And that's me. Oftentimes when people want to go out and wander around, I'm like, no, I'm going to sit down and just enjoy the ambiance.
I would not have put you as the Yaiko of the cast, but I guess that's you're a fussy sundae, Ben, apparently.
I guess. I don't know. I felt like the back half got increasingly more like, does this mangaka just, are they just really into like early to mid 2000s American pop culture? Because they mentioned like Samuel Jackson and Sum 41 and a bunch of old movies that like film nerds from high school and college would be really into. It is interesting how the focus of the anime moves, but it's always about these duos of girls finding connection over alcohol and often over other things. And in fact, one of the big crises at the end is like Botan becomes obsessed with the feeling that Ibuki does not actually want to hang out with her. She just likes having a drinking companion. And there's no there. And it's interesting to watch her transform from this eager enabler of fun to the person who's always like, are we having fun? Do you want to do something else? I'm sorry I brought you out. And how that changes the tenor of their relationship. And Ibuki is simply not able to pick it up because she's focusing on other things. This is something that happens in Ramparts of Ice, which we'll discuss later. But it's much better executed here in terms of just like the second guessing and how like alcohol is ultimately a band-aid and you can't build an entire relationship about just going out and getting a pint whenever someone feels insecure or tired or overwhelmed.
One thing I really liked about that end of it was that Botan and Ibuki's relationship is placed within the context of the other two relationships of Chinlan and Kanade and Yoko and Akane. You've had Yoko and Akane as like this sort of settled relationship for the good majority of the anime. It's kind of interesting because they're ahead of Botan and Ibuki's journey, and yet they still have their insecurities. Sort of like reach this finale where each of the couples is sort of coming to a resting place in this particular story. Like Yoko and Akane have been a long-running couple, but now Akane wants to fully devote herself to her music, and that's going to put stresses on it. Chinlan is like best girl, obviously, like because she's this combination of like bluntness and patience, which is really rare.
Yes,
the fact that she's able to sort of like stay in a moment without worrying about what comes next is, I think, really good. Like, she's definitely the most well-adjusted of the cast. And I think that's kind of what Kanade needed at that moment. You come out of a bad crush and you just find you're the perfectly competent girlfriend. And
that's a nice moment of inflection, too, when, as I was mentioning, how this reminded me a little bit of Yamada and Honey and Clover, where it's someone coming off of a big crush that's just not going to work out. And she's been rejected, not as explicitly as it happens in Honey and Clover, and the process of disadhesion from the object of affection is not as grueling and slow, but it is like they really have a detailed portrayal of the way that your attention can shift as you fully give up on someone as a possibility and then notice someone else in the room. And I don't know if I have a best girl this season, because I mean, between this and Awajima, I was kind of deluged with pretty cool girls, pretty neat girls. But I mean, it's nice to have a Chinese character or a Taiwanese character who is not a horrible caricature of money obsession, rudeness, and and general unpleasantness. Like, even like in Battle Athlete's Victory, like the awful Chinese stereotype they have there is still like the funniest and most human character in that show. So but I don't have to go cut against the grain here with Chinlan, because she just knows what she wants and she pushes very firmly for it. And she's the first person to be like, hey, are you two a thing? And we're just drinking buddies. And then it's, oh no, are we just drinking buddies? And yeah, it's good. It's small scale drama that, of exactly the kind I like, and it's very queer, and there are moments of like actual physical intimacy that's not abstract or symbolic or tokenized or queerbaiting. It's just,
I mean, there is also symbolic things too, because let
the stupid earrings.
Oh yeah, earrings. Someone getting pierced is definitely not a somewhat unsubtle metaphor.
Yeah, and she's got a hole that's just waiting to be filled.
Yeah, I was not expecting that from Ben, frankly.
Yeah. I'm tired. I had a rough week. I'm here to talk about it. I binged a lot of anime. Like, I would go to work, I'd come home, and I'd watch anime until I fell asleep because I was so behind on all my shows. But I'm all the way caught up.
Yeah,
I'm tired.
I watched 3 episodes of this show and I couldn't fucking stand it.
Well, the first 3 episodes are the most like baity episodes anyway, and they're more. It's weird how like alcohol disappears from the, like, as someone who just like liked them dropping like facts about beer and wine. The fact that they slowly like stopped talking about the beer and wine they were drinking, they're like let's just get a drink, and they'd have a drink. I'm like, what is it, an IPA? Is it a fruited sour? Like, tell me about the alcohol. Don't stop looking at each other so longingly.
I didn't even mind the little alcohol bits. For me, it was just the conversations were just too cringe. Like, when she was drunk and making these like really lame passes, I was like, fuck this, I'm so done. And it's a shame because there's a lot that I like. I love the visuals. I love the look of the show. I love the feel of the show. I love the vibes.
They did kind of drop the Botan being like a like horny savant when she's drunk. Like, that was a big element of the first 2 or 3 episodes.
They should have dropped it episode 2 because otherwise I would have watched more.
No, it is horny. It is a horny show.
I would, and I'm not against horniness. I just, it's just
cut it.
The way... It's just the way that the horniness is done in this show just makes me, like, I guess, kind of cringe.
I think most people are cringe when they're drunk, though.
Yeah. It's very authentic, though, I feel.
I don't think it is authentic.
When was the last time you were a drunk college student?
Oh, Andy, I have horrible news for you, Andy. You probably thought you were the coolest guy in the room, but I have horrible, horrible news.
He's a great dancer too when he's drunk. Yeah, just.
Oh yeah, I pull off the best fucking moves. I never thought I was that, but like that. This just doesn't do anything for me. I want to watch.
It's fair.
It's the worst thing I've watched this season by a landslide.
No, that's not true.
It is absolutely fucking true.
But you've also barely watched anything this season, so and barely watched any of it. So
he's saying worse than Dr. Stone is what he's saying.
Oh, yeah, but there's a lot that's worse than Dr. Stone. It's hard to beat, genuinely hard to beat Dr. Stone. Dr. Stone's incredible. My problem with Botan, like, I want to watch it on like a chill pop like playlist. Oh. Like
to study and relax too.
Yeah, to study and relax too, and just have that play and not know anything about the story and just enjoy the visuals. Good if you want good queer baiting.
It doesn't queer bait. That's the entire point. No, sorry. Andy.
If you want a good queer show,
queer catching.
Wait until the guy I liked wasn't a guy at all. But that's gonna fucking grow.
I mean, no offense. I've read that and I like it a lot, but I highly put it below Botan.
Absolutely fucking not. It's so much better than Botan.
I think Botan is also sort of self-aware of being a Yuri show. Like,
Botan is the kind of Yuri show where there is just no men. And I find that like really weird. Of course, you're at the age where you're trying to find a romantic interest and a romantic partner, but you only know the people you know. And if they're all women, then this show, I just feel this show is trying to like force them into a relationship.
It's also a college show where we never see them go to class. Like, it's the stuff that's not important to what they're trying to say isn't in the anime. You don't complain that they didn't go to class enough in this anime about being in college.
I don't even know if they got to the point where they were having classes. Like, it could have just been Freshers Week for the whole of the fucking show, as far as I'm aware.
I'm sad we didn't use my segue to switch to Awajima. No, it's okay. But it's okay.
You have regrets now, Ben. You have deep regrets. So
the son who was like, I don't care if she had regrets. This is emotionally exploited. So yeah, no, Awajima Hieki is a show about a drama school and the many people and types of people who go to the school and who drop out of the school and who live lives that are indelibly marked by the school and how they all relate to each other and to the ideal of Awa Jima and to the experience of having to be around other people, especially awful teenage girls. And yeah, it's, I remember joking about it when it first came out, like, oh, we're just going to have, like, we're going to do three faces an episode and we'll hit 100 faces by the end of, by the end of the episode. But it actually became this kind of wonderfully twisted, like gnarled, doubling back on itself story of all these people and how they relate and just daisy chaining through the alumni and current students and what Awa Jima means to them, what it means to have chosen to embark on this career, what it means to give it up, I think is ultimately what, like,
before acting. Yeah. Right. Okay.
Cause it, like, I would say the majority of what we focus on are people who at some point cease to, like, they retire or they do something that's related, like script writing or journalism or editing. But it is enjoyable to have two shows that I think honestly have a lot of the same thematic concerns but are presented so differently because, as I said, Botan is very experimental. There's different cinematographic styles, different genre appeals in the various episodes, and there are different stories in Awa Jima, but it's primarily the same story filtered through the many different ways that people can be and how they all share one dream, but it's not the same dream, even though we just say, like, acting as a single concept. I don't know. I know that you enjoyed this too, Duncan.
I'm not sure if it's a positive or a negative thing, but this is the first time in a while we've had, like, kind of an author insert pop up in the final couple of episodes to sort of, like, clarify the plots and the themes of that the show's been trying for. I think I can understand why that's sort of needed when you've done a morally grey, multi-generation, non-linear story, because it certainly did get pretty hard to track who was who at sometimes.
Yeah.
But I do think it is, like, a really rich story. Like, it, like, at the end, like, the thing that it wants to hammer home and which our author in Wakana, who it is...
I mean, she's the first character we encounter.
Yeah.
She's the...
Who it turns out has written a book called 100 Scenes of Awa Jima, which is
a controversial book.
This one incident of bullying and how it sort of, like, rippled out. But what she makes clear is that she wants to tell about the lives of both the perpetrator and the victim, and that in both cases, those labels did not define them. They were not just the perpetrator. They were not just the victim. They went on and they did more. In one case... I think that's another Ibuki. Yeah, she was Miss Ibuki.
Katsurako, yeah.
Yeah, we talked previously about her comment of, like, of not wanting to repeat the toxic sort of legacy of her grandmother. We see over the show her guilt over having this moment where she lets herself do that and how she goes on to spend the rest of her life kind of trying to atone for that.
Yes, exactly the word I'd use.
Yeah, and... I really enjoyed that, like, she doesn't, like, just become this sweet teacher. She still retains this sort of, like, severe exterior to her. Like, she still can't change her nature. She still is who she is. And that she, that sort of knowledge of her own mistakes sort of allows her to go on and do different. But what I thought was probably the bit which sort of, like, really stands out for me is how the other half of that incident, Akabi Emi, is treated by the show. She's not just a victim. Mm-hmm. She's sort of, like, driven out by this bullying. And early on, we get this scene where she's sort of, like, sitting on a bus, sort of, like, fully coming to terms with the idea that she really was ambitious. She was prepared to leave her family and her friends behind her to achieve what she wanted, but that she couldn't sustain that. That's gone. That she in the face of other people's hostility, the sort of companionship she sort of hope to replace, like, the family and friends she was giving up, it wasn't there. She just found envy instead.
Yeah.
And she sort of breaks down, and she's just in that moment, it just leaves her on a bus crying. And, like, that was a beautiful moment. But what I thought made it really good is that at the end, we return to that moment. We again see her crying, but then we see her sort of, we see the camera keep running. And we see the tears stop, and we see her wipe her eyes, and we see her look up and look forward. through the rest of those episodes, we get a sense of who she became.
Yeah, no, I talked about, I've said multiple times about experimentalness, but I do like the story experimentalness in Awajima, especially where it constantly reminds us that these snapshots, that this period of them attending the school was the most important thing in their life and didn't matter at all for like who they became.
Yes.
And the way that that exists, and that you just, you stop the story at a different point, you pick a different viewpoint, and the story becomes the exact same story. And at the same time, it is always the same story about a girl comes to school, realizes what she wants to do with her life, and then goes off and does it. And there's no failures or successes. There's just people living their life. And some of them sure get to live out the life that they came up with as a stupid kid, or promised to a friend on a whim. We have several instances of people who decide to go to Awajima, this like hothouse of catty backstabbing, because their friends just like, let's be on stage together, and like, okay, and that's a million different shows. That's like literally what Review Starlight starts out with, is the promise of like being on stage together. But the fascinating thing about making it about Okabe Emi is just that she died and we barely know anything about her besides what other people know. And it's only able to be a story about anything because we have this limited information, and we have, like, she's not going to jump out of the grave and add more to her story, to her storied career. And then we get that scene at the end, yeah, where we see that, like, she left in tears, and then she like, steeled herself, and she lived the rest of her life and seems to have lived a pretty, like, wonderful, valid, fulfilling life. And it just challenges us to realize that we don't know anything about all these characters that we've, you know, dozens of characters. The show is such a chore when it comes to trying to keep track of who the fuck is who. Like, I know Katsuraku Ibuki because that's the one name I learned. I was like, okay, Katsuraku Ibuki and the sleepy-eyed one. They changed her name and I lost both of them now. But there are a couple of characters I latched onto. But otherwise, you're just kind of like watching this churn of girls and watch it slowly resolve into this message about how, like, how awful it is that we must choose at such a young age what we want to do with the rest of our lives, and how silly to think we can, even though we have to, is what moved me.
Yuri shows often have this sort of preoccupation about, like, potential. Like, obviously, like, the phrase itself just is about blossoming, like, about this idea, like, of potential being realized. And, like, Arajima's melancholy often comes from potential not being realized, that there's this gap between what someone could do and what they do. And... Yeah. I think, like, that's... Yes, the moment I said that, I knew. I was like, in my head, I was like, oh, I should do. Andy's gonna say something here.
10, I tried to keep my face 9, as still as possible. 8, it's not my 7, fault. This isn't like you snickering at filling a hole and getting Andy to laugh.
Yeah.
You're such a saboteur.
I'm such a child.
But yeah, it was a wonderful show, despite being far more visually constrained. It was a very light watercolor style to it. Like, it was not visually experimental in the same way that Botan was, but it was sort of a restrained beauty throughout.
And their one artistic flourish was the, like, half-transparent people walking around the halls, which really became a dominant metaphor. It's just that this is a haunted school, just because people leave their dreams here and don't come back sometimes. Yeah. And so, yeah, spooky in a sentimental way. But I like sentimental stuff. I watched a lot of sentimental shows this season.
Yeah. Sentimental shows about ice and ramparts.
This is sadly my biggest disappointment, and not because it's not, like, perfectly competent, but it was just the worst possible circumstances under which to watch it, immediately after you and I are polar opposites, to watch The Ramparts of Ice, which asks, what if Polar Opposites was a lot less positive and refreshing and had less momentum and was more about an anxious girl who's been horribly bullied being permanently stuck in her head and trying to, like, connect to anyone. So yeah. we have Koyun as her friends call her, who was kind of bullied into dating this guy who just kept pestering her about getting together. And they had an awful relationship that she blames herself for not being accommodating and friendly and nice enough to make work. And she has other enemies from people who liked this guy. And so she just comes into high school just a fucking mess. And she is afraid of everybody. Every person she meets, she's like, should I be here or should I leave? Is this person going to bully me or am I being rude to them? And the whole show is just a new character is introduced, or she gets closer to a character and she's like, am I allowed to be here? Does this person want to do me harm? And it is sadly kind of repetitive. And there's one episode left to go. And they have set up a couple of things that now there's a jealous girl who wants to get with the boy that Ko-yoon is so painfully slowly drifting towards, acknowledging her feelings in a way that is more than just whispering it to someone while the camera's on the other side of the fucking room so we can't hear it or see it or anything. And the guy that she's friends with who's helped her come out of her shell admits that he's got a crush on her best friend. They're setting up clearly in the season that these confessions are going to happen, and I bet you dollars to donuts they're fucking not. And I want to go back to polar opposites. When people have a problem in polar opposites, or when they have an anxiety, they tell a friend and their friend's like, yeah, just tell the person how you feel. And that is like completely missing from this previous work by the same mangaka. Like, it's like they had an epiphany and they're like, oh, my characters can just talk to each other about how they feel. And I don't have to spend most of the anime in this like painfully traumatized girl's head as she like questions whether she should exist with every social interaction. And yeah, the designs are cute. I like a mean-eyed girl with chunky bangs, but no. This ain't it.
It's very clear that it's like a debut work from a mangaka.
It's the same show. And the characters from Polar Opposites show up in a couple scenes too. They're like at the McDonald's with them.
Which I believe must be a retroactive thing. So I couldn't believe that's in the manga. Although, full confession, I haven't read it.
They want to reassure me that Polar Opposites is still there. I don't need to worry.
I haven't gotten very far, but I liked it. It's fun to kind of... It is interesting and seeing the original sort of like litmus test for this kind of show.
Yeah, the formula coming together.
Yeah. And I like what I've watched, but I can also fully understand your point of like, I'm just tired of this shit now, bro.
It's not their fault. Like, I like all the characters. It's just that everyone is stuck in their heads and none of the interesting drama happens out in the real world. It happens in people making up a problem, freaking out about it, and then having that problem resolve itself. But because they can't proactively do anything. It's all these damaged people pulling back from each other. And so the problem always just fixes itself by like someone blundering in the situation and saying the thing everyone's afraid to say. And it just, it feels a lot clunkier, especially after, I mean, I know Duncan didn't really like Polar Opposites, but just like the characters talk to each other in Polar Opposites. And now, and to have the exact same style of anime storytelling, except they don't talk to each other, is just, it's really unfortunate, because this probably would be an 8 or a 9 for me if I had watched it in isolation, but it's middle score.
It's good that you're getting to see the growth of this creator, like to see the beginning of their work and see the end of it. And speaking of which, Andy, I think you've seen the end of one of your favorite works.
Well, I mean, I know that the last episode of Dr. Stone, what is it, Science Future? Part 3. It ends with the end, and then underneath it, it says to be continued. So someone's fucking pulling the absolute bullshit.
Let this get normalized.
I blame Avengers. Or Attack on Titan. Attack on Titan never fucking finished, and they kept. But yeah, like this is the final season of Dr. Stone. They go to fucking space. It's great. Like,
what is the moon if not the biggest stone?
Exactly. Like, Dr. Stone is one of the best shonens that is just consistently well, like, It's not One Piece. One Piece is clearly the best shonen. But, like, as far as a show that is consistent with its, like, lore, consistent with its world and characters, but then also, like, never sways from, like, what it's trying to be, which is essentially, like, Age of Mythology, but, like, on a hyper scale where you, like, start with, like, cracking rocks and then you get up to fucking flying a space, like, a ship to space. There was a great season where they're trying to just test rockets and they had so many of them fail and so many of them just explode or just, like, do three spins and then blow up. And I'm just like, this is just Kerbal Space Program, like, as an anime. And it has those little joys of like, of struggling and failing and then, like, succeeding. And, yeah, like...
You mentioned, like, the Kerbalness and the exploding rockets and stuff. Like, one thing which is you're supposed to talk about science is that, okay, a failure of an experiment is just as valuable as a success. Like, it's like failing a big part of it. Do you get lots of small setbacks? Because I think one of the things which really annoys me about certain shows is, like, they are just a series of characters just getting more and more powerful and never and more and less fallible. And I like the concept of maybe having a shonen show where people still fuck up.
Yeah, people fuck up, and, like, Senku as a main character is a genius, and you've just got to accept that he has an encyclopedic knowledge of how literally everything is made, like it's Minecraft.
He's just Michelangelo. He's just, like, the fictional idea of Michelangelo.
He just knows how plastic is made, and he just knows how shit that we wouldn't, like, give two fucks, like, think twice about. Like, but that's fine. It's shonen crow. But, like, but when it gets to where we are now, where it is, like, him going to space, which at the beginning you see him build rockets with his friends, and, like, he's never able to do it. Like, he is now at the point where he doesn't have this knowledge. This is always what he's wanted to do. And he just doesn't have the skill or expertise. No, there's another character who comes in as well, who is literally a NASA scientist. And he's fucking great.
They're really lucky with who survived the real, like, petrification of the entire world, huh?
It is a thing that's very easily solved. But then when they stop being in Japan and then go overseas to America, there is then the thing where it's just like... there's probably life out there in space. There's probably someone else who's managed to work out or freakishly be de-stoned. It's good. Like, that's fun. It's good and it's fun. And it's just as much melodramatic stupidness as it is, like, genuinely, like, engaging, gripping drama. I really love Dr. Stone. And I can see... I'm happy that it got to the very end, and... I'm looking forward to, like, just eating up the last couple of episodes, because it does remind me also of, like, the world building that we enjoyed initially of Slime, but unlike Slime, it just keeps getting into, like, world building and, like, like, progressing humankind in a way that is enjoyable and weird, and there are, like, factions of people who want capitalism, and then Senku's just like, fine, I guess we'll do capitalism if it means that you can just do the thing that I want you to do.
Yeah, it's good to hear, like, it has, like, that consistency of vision, because I think often the thing which, like, distinguishes a great science fiction is, like, you have one core idea and you explore that to its maximum degree or maximum absurdity, as the case may be.
Yeah, and I also like how, unlike a lot of shonen, where they just introduce another layer of bullshit on top of the powers that they're fucking using, there's none of that. It's just like, no, there's just like one weird device that, like, everyone gets turned into stone one day and they don't know why. Mm. And you discover why and you work out why. And you're like, okay, that's cool. It's really good. Like, it's just good. It's just, I don't really have many negative things to say about it. I wish it was more well animated. Hmm. I wish it had a bit more budget on some of the events. But when they pull in the budget for like the more like impactful scenes, it really lands. There's a whole bit with Suica at the end of part three, which just had me in tears. It's just got characters that you love, you grow to love, even with their weird foibles. And you just love seeing them work together to achieve something. It's that simple. It's that satisfying.
I know we have another science fiction this season based around one big idea, which maybe Ben would like to tell us about.
Wait, which big idea?
You know, like everyone's a replica.
Oh, yeah. I wish Jeff was here for this.
Does it just abandon that? Is it like, nah, no one's
replica? You don't know what you're talking about, Duncan.
Good. Tell me.
I got jeffed by even a replica can fall in love. I really wish that this could have been the springboard for him to watch Migito Dali. So this is a show where we look from the perspective of this girl who ends up being a like perfect clone of a girl, and she can summon her at will and unsummon her at will, and she is like not controlled by the original quote unquote girl's like will, but she does like obviously have like a great affection towards her. This also has one more episode to go, and I much more than Ramparts of Ice, I wish I could have seen it before putting my thoughts on the internet permanently until our website gets taken down. But it
any day now.
It's a show that is fascinating because it feels so much like a metaphor, but it plays out just so straightforwardly. I think I made the comment that it is very funny how so much of the show is about wanting to fit in, to feel like there is someone's shoes you're supposed to fill, and that person is at home and depressed and sleeping all day. And so you go and you try to live their life in a way that is entertaining to you, but also in a way that if they choose to take up their life again, as happens to Sunao later when she just decides to get out of bed one episode and tell Nao, her clone, that she wants her life back. It just feels like an allegory about depression. And it's one of those things where I would not be surprised to see an A&N interview where the mangaka is like, or light novel author is like, no, this isn't a metaphor for anything. I just thought it'd be a cool idea if everyone could just summon clones.
I just watched one season of Severance.
And then I played out like what happens when you let someone else live your life. They make different friends and fall in love with different people, and they eventually get caught because, you know, you're not a perfect clone. And it's been very interesting how over and over the threat is like, this person's going to find out that clones are real. And then the answer is either, oh, I have a clone too. Actually, or oh, I am a clone. Or the answer is, oh, you're a clone? Yeah, I kind of figured. Like, you're really different from you're different from the Sunao I know.
The high stakes completely like cut.
Yeah, no, it's just a school drama. Like there's this whole arc where they find out that the student council president, who's had like a big change in personality, is a clone who was summoned when the girl was very young. Spoilers, sorry.
I'm not gonna watch it.
And she was sent away to like live in Kyushu while the original didn't want to unsummon her. And then the original goes into a coma and they summon back the clone to live her life for her, and then she dies in the coma and the girl disappears in the middle of addressing a school assembly. What happens? Nothing. People are kind of freaked out about it, but it just gradually like gets accepted. There's like these traumatic.
So wait, they get never accepted that clones exist, or this person just vanished?
No, so they're like, oh, this must have been a mass hallucination. We all loved the student council president so much that we all hallucinated that she was at school for these 3 months when in fact she's been in a coma.
There must have been a fucking mass hallucination for people to believe that would be an acceptable plot point.
I don't want to retread the plot points or their plausibility. What I want to say is that replica, it's better than you think. Replica never fails to do the most interesting thing, but it just has such a pedestrian way of executing itself that I keep feeling like there's something not there. And what it makes me think of is if I got like a monkey's paw wish for 16-bit layer, another sensation, or 16-bit sensation, another layer, where, like, it's aliens at the end. And this feels like what would have happened if it wasn't aliens. And just, like, she'd get to live her alternate video game life, and then she'd go back to her regular life and be like, oh, that was a cool little time. And it's, like, I don't like the aliens in 16-bit, but I appreciate the sense of escalation. Mm. While here, like, the most recent episode, they just full-on confess to several other people in their lives, like, we're clones, like, we've given back our originals to their lives, we're gonna, like, run off and date and, like, hopefully, like, find a way to get into college, and just, like, live our lives knowing that, like, our original will die someday and we'll be instantly unsummoned, because they can't die. Like, if you get hit, you get hit by a truck, you get unsummoned, and you can just come back. So I've spoiled too much, because I do think that, like, coming along and being like, okay, so they're obviously going to, like, tie off the concept and try to, like, recontextualize it to something that's not so much focused around the risk of discovery, but instead it just kind of keeps going and keeps going. And I'm glad I watched it. I think it's just such a bizarre work, because it feels so light novel-y, and it's got this really interesting premise that it's just delivering to you exactly how, like, if you just wished for the most, like, rote, that's not fair. If you just wished for the most, like, unremarkable take on everyone's got a doppelganger and they're a metaphor for depression. When you're depressed, your doppelganger goes to school instead of you. You would get this. And there's cool stuff. Like, when Sunao takes back over her life, she realizes she has all these friends that Nao made. And she's like, hey, I guess I wasn't so, like, unlikable. Like, I'm actually kind of fortunate to have all these people and to have a clone who tried so hard to like, keep my life intact while I was just spending all day in bed scrolling on the phone and telling my clone to do my homework for me. Like, I don't know. I'm glad I watched it. It's one of the examples of how inventive anime can be. And it is very inventive. It's just also, like, light novel as fuck, so.
But it's full severance, right? Like, if she dismisses the clone, she's not going to get the clone's memories back.
No,
she?
Yeah. The clone has, like, vague impressions of the original's, like, memories and emotions, but they're distinct people. Yeah.
But then the main character's wrong. The main character doesn't have friends.
She does, though. That's the thing, is she comes in and she's like, all these people are going to clock me immediately as different, and they don't care. They're just happy to be around her, and she kind of has to realize that, like, there's nothing that different between her and the clone, because she had spent previous episodes being like, I'm sad and I can't get along with people, and my clone went to school and got a boyfriend in, like, a month. So
it's not her, though, right? It's not her that the people like.
But it's based on her.
Visually, I guess. But, like, characteristic.
She also wears her hair differently, so it's not visually.
you have to give them a signal so you know which is which.
It's not teaching her a lesson about her inherent worthiness. It's just the idea that she was really obsessed with, like, my clone is charismatic and I'm not. And she goes to school and she's like, no, these are just nice people. My clone found some nice people and they're friends now. And they don't care that I'm, like, withdrawn and less of a good conversationalist than I usually am. They're still, like, nice to me. And it's still, like, an emotionally gratifying experience.
They like the person that is not her. Like, they liked the other clone who...
But they like her too. The thing is, they like her too. That's the message. Take us away, Duncan.
Shall we have our break?
All right. Our clones can't use the bathroom for us. Let's go ahead and do that, and then we'll be back to talk about the rest of the shows. And we're back. For the second half, we will be talking about Witch Hat Atelier, Akane Banashi,
And an extremely light novel titled Agents of the Four Seasons, Dance of Spring.
I keep forgetting that. People say it's strangely beautiful and very good, and I'm excited to hear you sell me on it the way I anti-sold Andy on Replica.
This is an action drama where basically each of the four seasons is manifested in and manifested by one person, and it's preoccupied with all the implications of that. I'd say if you're looking for a show with a similar vibe, it's kind of action fruits baskets. It's very much not coy about the kind of story it's telling. Like, this is a story about normal people under the weight of supernatural things breaking. And it's really took it to some extremes at times. And one of our heroines, Hinagaku, is kidnapped in the sort of prologue. And essentially she is gone for like most of her youth. And when she returns from that kidnapping, she essentially considers herself a different person to the one which is kidnapped. Maybe like you were talking about in Replica. This is leaning hard into melodrama. People in the rain shouting, "Oh, it hurts! It hurts! It's that kind of show."
Mary Okada-ism.
Yeah, it's and the thing about it is, I found it kind of weirdly unsettling to have a show which is sort of like doing the quiet part loud. I think a lot of anime is very melodramatic. I had this conversation with John, and like he highlighted how like the vocal performances in a lot of anime and in J-dramas as well is very exaggerated and very melodramatic. Mm-hmm. And that can often be really off-putting to people coming to the medium from Western entertainment, where subtlety is prized, is valued, even if it is not actually true. People, the thing you are supposed to value is subtlety. The other thing is, I feel like melodrama can be really wearing if it's just non-stop melodrama. This show is based on a novel which is written by the same person who wrote Violet Evergarden. Mm. And as you guys know, I was not necessarily the fondest of that show. There's only so many times you can sort of like... or at least I can tolerate the music swelling as people sort of like burst into tears and tell us their feelings. What works for me, at least, is that the good writers of melodrama deal with that sort of exaggerated weight of emotions by breaking it up with little bits of levity or calm. And so you need Hinagaku's tsundere best friend, Sakura, like, as a counterweight to her. She's loud and a bit of a dumbass, a bit of a mess, frankly, but all her energy is pointed forward, whereas all Hinagaku's insecurities are pointed inward. Like, you need dumb faces to sort of counterweight sort of like kidnappings, rape, people dropping ballistic missiles on a six-year-old. The show ends on top of a skyscraper with the villain saying, "I've wired it all to blow up."
Oh, cool. So it's like Horus Recoil. Cool. Okay.
And like, it's such a exaggerated premise that after that big final conflict's resolved and the good guys win, poor Hinagaku's finally going to get to meet her childhood love, one of the other incarnations of the seasons, Rose, the sort of agent of winter. And I thought it would be similarly dramatic, you know, like running to each other's arms, crying, breaking down into tears, etc. But it's not. It's quiet. It's a girl telling someone that the version of herself that he cared for is gone. That version loved him, but that version doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And like, the lazy bad response to that would have been him saying, "I still love," but he doesn't do that. He says, "I loved her," but thanks her for expressing the feelings of that person who she was to him, so he knew. And like, I'm probably an easy target for that sort of sentimentality because...
Boy, don't I know.
And at the moment, particularly, because I found out an old friend I hadn't heard of from a couple of months had a horrible thing happen to him. And, like, it reminded me that there's still something very powerful in just the feeling of, I'm glad you're alive. I'm glad you're still here. I'm glad you're here to tell me those things. And for this show to... which had been so bombastic to end on such a simple but very human emotion was actually far better than I thought it would do. It's Studio Wit, so it looks fantastic generally throughout, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend it to someone, but I'm glad for the time I spent with it. I do think like it my big takeaway is it has made me far more aware of melodrama, of like the and how often in anime we'll get a show about some minor thing and it becomes life and death for every character. Everything you two have told me about Akane Banashee has made it sound very melodramatic to me.
I call it Akane Banashee.
I call it Akane Banashee because you should have shot that guy.
You absolutely should have shot that fucking guy.
When he's like, you know what? Your dad sucked. Like, people felt sorry for
everybody
him.
Everybody step out, and she's just like, I got a gun. Bam, motherfucker.
Yeah. Like, she could have a knife. Do the classic bam. Charge where you and then it becomes a different show.
Not melodramatic enough, basically.
She puts a katana in, and she's like, ah!
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. And she's like, that's what I say to the Rakugo revival that you started by firing some random guy from his apprenticeship a decade ago.
That would be so funny. That would be so good.
It's easy to make fun of Akane Banashi because it definitely, insofar as like shonen hyper dramatizations of extremely boring things, this is up there with some of the most. And I love Rakugo, like. Sailor Setsuma Sensei has multiple Rakugo jokes. I Joshi Raku. I watched a bit of Showa Rakugo. The mm-hmm. other two words, mm-hmm. I don't remember. But it's so funny with Akane Banashi. I was complaining, I remember, on the podcast that, like, they don't just let me see the fucking performance. They keep cutting away to someone being like, she's doing so good. This is really good. She's doing good. And I'm like, Don't pander to me, anime. Don't condescend to me. I can tell when a story is good. If I didn't, I wouldn't be here watching it. So, but I do. I think Akane's design is great. I enjoy the performance. I think it's fun to have like a cute little punk rock girl who's gonna rock the Rakugo world with her like senior fellow apprentices and her like. Tough guy, but like also sweetheart master, and the evil bad Rakugo guy who just has standards, and his council of weird Rakugo masters who we just have introduced in the last episode to remind you it's a shonen show. I don't know. I like it. The last episode really clinched it for me because I was kind of going back and forth. But the last episode, where so much of it is just him like walking around being like a pillar of his community.
Shigemo, this is? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really good.
And then he gave Akane her name as well.
Uh huh. And it was the same name, which is hard to understand in translation.
Yeah. That actually was all original. Can you guess what scenes weren't original, Ben?
Council.
Yeah, the council.
The evil Rakugo Master Council.
And it's weird because the council kind of never appear in that sort of getup.
And they're all like freaks too, of course. No one's just like a guy.
I just love the overdrim, like this kind of like constant shonen thing of making this one person a bad guy and an asshole and evil, and it's like he's done so much, but he's also a bad person in the main protagonist's eyes. And then her sitting down and trying to, hoping to get the fucking slam dunk on him. And what actually happened was that the reason why he got a good reception was because people felt bad for him. That like breaking of the wall of being from like a purely evil person to someone who is actually got nuance and character and interest. Fantastic.
I do think so too. And I always kind of suspected that each show would just have good reasons. But seeing it executed, and it was funny because of our conversation and you feeling that you'd gaslit yourself into like this expulsion causing a Rakugo renaissance. Yeah. And I remember listening to that. I'm like, man, Andy just has the most, I think I even tell you that you just have these vivid daydreams. You're 100% right. This guy fired a couple of apprentices and it just like, oh man. And everyone's into Rakugo now.
Rakugo's badass. But what I guess like you don't get from the manga that you do get in spades in the anime that I genuinely love with the anime is the feeling of, even though this is now like the hottest shit in the world, they are still playing these like really dainty, really twee, dusty, old school venues that like they're playing to old people. Or like tiny little community halls. Yeah. After reading Akane Banashi, when I was in Japan, there was one Rakugo performance a month in Tokyo. That is in English. And I was like, I'm going
to ask.
I'm gonna go. Like, it's not like they're not like the levels of Isho or Shigemura. They're very much at the level of Akane, like the sort of the junior Rakugo, but they were doing it in English, and it was really cool because, like, watching the anime, I got that, like, that was what it was like seeing Rakugo. Like, that first one where they were in the cafe, that was how it was like watching Rakugo. It was fascinating. It was really good. If I had a problem with this adaptation, I feel that, like, your point about let them tell the fucking story is the bit that they missed. And I feel that the manga, the voice actors that they've got does a very good job. Like, yeah. Akane's voice actor, when she goes into, like, Rakugo, it's very good. And you can tell that she's practiced and learned. But there is just, like, a very prolonged scene that they just skipped entirely about, because it's Jugemu, which is like the basic Rakugo performance. Everyone knows Jugemu. They get into the pronunciation of Jugemu, and they get into how, like, as the story progresses, Akane says Jugemu in like 5 breaths, then 4 breaths, then 3 breaths, then 2 breaths, and then in 1 breath. She does do it in 1 breath. So she's clearly, they say that a very good, like, editor, or B, she actually learned how to do this. That, in my opinion, is kind of like the spice, like, kind of like the real grit of why I loved the manga, is because they would actually bother to go into the details of, like, performing Rakugo, which they have missed almost entirely, preferring instead just to get to the characters, who I do, which I do love.
So what would be the longest performance you get? Do you get like a full 10-minute one, or?
It's never in one go. That's the thing. Okay, like, you can talk about net performance, but there's a certain directorial insecurity where we have to cut away the characters who've been established as knowledgeable about Rakugo, explaining what's good about what we're seeing. And I understand that. I'm no great elitist, but also, like, You want to take how much time you think the audience can sit with a given stylistic element and double it just to, like, let them marinate in it before you cut away to some guy being like, oh, she's modulating her voice.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I grew out a long time ago with, like, watching shonen fights where someone's just like, oh, he's doing a super kick. That's twice as good as a regular kick. I hate that stuff. Yeah. And, like, I don't mind it because anime is for children, but, like, let me watch the thing when it's a thing that they're doing.
Yeah, let me be able to form my own opinion of that without having someone else tell me how I should be feeling.
I think that's fine to do for sports, but this is literally, they tell a story and you experience them telling the story. And there's absolutely no fucking reason they can't do that to camera.
No, they want to let you know that you are witnessing excellent voice control, excellent breath control, and excellent pitch control, and excellent body posture. Yeah. And, like, it makes me wish it was kind of a, like, more, like, goofy and surreal, where you could just have, like, the pop-up text with an arrow being like, holding her shoulders right this time, or something like that, to, like, not stop the vocal performance, because the physical performance is part of Rakugo, but the big thing, especially with Jugemu, is just the vocal feat of just saying this dumb long name over and over and over again, and making it the kind of, like, the joke that just won't go away.
Yeah.
And when you give the audience a break by stopping to explain what's impressive about what you're seeing, it kind of just lessens the impact. To bring it back to the meeting between Akane and Isho, the idea that Akane's father was uniquely pandering to the audience in a way that's unbefitting, like, Isho panders wildly while he's the judge. Like, he does the whole, like, pretends he's giving them a criticism and then swaps around to a compliment. That's pandering to the audience. He could just not be a dick about it, but, like, his whole character is that he's right, but he's a dick about it. And so that's one thing, but you have to acknowledge that you have to see someone, like, execute something in full to really appreciate it. And I understand why they don't do it this way, but it is just one thing where you can use the weird hang time of manga. Your eyes will skip naturally over the non-story parts if you're just trying to follow it. But if you're going to have it in, live act, if you're going to have a real person performing it.
There are cutaways in the manga. They go to the reporter and the reporter is saying, like, this is really good. Like, look at the...
They're all saying this is really good. That's what they all do.
The difference is that in the manga, you can just stop time kind of in that point where the story's been played in front of these characters. There is still story that is being told. So you've got to then have, like, they're trying to do it like realistic in time and not the Kuroko no Basuke thing people have like telepathic communications and finish their sentences. Like they you can still hear the performance going on in the background.
The most disappointing thing in Akane Banashi is when they duck the audio.
Yes.
And I'm like, don't duck the audio. Like, let me.
It kind of can't work in a way because these stories, Rakugo stories, can take up to like 20 minutes to tell.
Yeah. No, it could be a whole episode. It's just one Rakugo story.
But I would rather it be one whole episode.
This is why we have an anime podcast. Like, I also want Impossible Things, Andy.
But they don't have a choice because... So the good news is that it's got a season two, which I am very happy to hear. And But like, they can't get away from telling Rakugo stories and they can't cut it down, and they will have to animate Akane speaking for 15 to 20 minutes because that is literally the highlight of the story that they are trying to tell.
I can't remember if you watched Showa Genroku Rakugo Shinju or not, Andy.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was very good.
Would you be happy losing the sort of like the big supporting cast that Akane Banashi has if it meant getting more focused on just Akane, her nemesis, and her journey?
No, because you need the supporting cast. If anything, I think that what it should have done was cut off like the weird chaff that's at the beginning, because this like fucking weird bit where Akane's explaining to a foreigner what it's like to eat noodles, and they could have just moved on. I genuinely feel that they fucked up.
The pacing in general is kind of odd in the show. I'm glad that we're past the Kuroko Cup because it feels like we're now in the main body of the anime.
Yeah.
It's... I like the supporting cast. I think all of them and their different... The guy who... I mean, of course, I like the guy who's like... He researches like the history of every story.
And then there's
like the Playboy guy. And then there's like the super disciplined shaved head guy. Mm-hmm. Like everyone's got a different approach to Rakugo. And it's nice to meet them. But... I would have had less of something. I don't need the shonen signposting. This is for, I mean, this show is 100% for like 9-year-olds who've never even thought about Rakugo before. And they need to be like, oh, his breath control is really good. It's like I'm watching a movie with a friend who just keeps turning to me and saying shit. And I'm like, stop it. Stop it.
Yes.
Tell me after. Tell me after the show.
It's very that. And also like, going back to that, like that last episode, that meeting of like the evil council meeting, like in the manga, all those characters hadn't been introduced. I do like that they've gone back to certain like characters and certain like I like that, especially when they add Zensho, who is also quite a fun like heel. But I do wish that they could have just gotten to the Kuroko Cup a few episodes faster. Like they didn't need a lot of it.
What happened, and we can't, there's no answer to this, so this is just a way of transitioning out of this conversation, but what happened to beginning adaptations in media race, and you just lop off the first two volumes?
Oh yeah.
Just lop them off.
Yeah.
Do like their flashback fodder. Great. Mm. If you have a production delay, have a flashback about when she was practicing Jugemu. We don't have to adapt the whole thing in chronological order.
Speaking about not doing anything to exhaustion, shall we wrap this up?
Oh, we're not going to talk about Witch Hat Atelier? I liked it. I mean,
let's talk about Witch Hat Atelier. Yeah.
I liked it. I found its imagination and compelling. I think it has the same issues where it thinks I'm a dumb motherfucker, and that's because it's for kids, but I'll keep watching it. The end.
Yeah, I dropped off it just because I had too much stuff to do. That I saw some posts about like that shot where he like comes in and kills the dragon, and people are like, it's 40,000 like drawings all done in like 5 minutes, and I'm like,
that's Mr. Beastism. These are Mr. Beastisms. I don't need to know how many numbers was. Does it look good or not?
there is someone who is like, this is my first anime, and they've lost their fucking minds.
I have someone on social media who said this is the most important anime she's watched in a decade, and I love her for that. We got an immediate fight when I was like, I don't know. I don't really care about the Agat and Coco stuff. I know people are really into the queer baiting there. I like Quilfy and his like secret war against the brimmed hats. I'm excited to see where that goes. And speaking of like anime antagonists who are not wrong, they're just huge assholes. I like the whole Orochimaru vibe of the brimmed hats, and I'm sure it's going to become tiresome, but I look forward to seeing where it goes. The end. So next episode, we will be talking about the landmark anime movie Akira by Katsuhiro Otomo. I am also reading the manga for the first time. I have the last three volumes on my shelf. I dropped those to spend all my time catching up on this season of anime. But I'm excited to go back. Even though I think I like the movie better. Spoilers. But in the meantime, rate, review, and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Facebook. Search for Keyframes Podcast. Find us on Blue Sky at Keyframes Pod. Email us questions, keyframespodcast@gmail.com. And most of all, tell a friend.
But not just any friend. Tell the friend who, in the middle of a story, just interrupts you and goes, I was going to do that one. I remember this bit. Like, fuck me, I hate it. I have a friend who I just stopped going to the cinema with because he keeps doing that. Really pisses me off. I'm like, don't talk in the middle of the film, mate. Respect the art.
My mother hates, I make fun of her all the time, that like if something bad's happening in a movie, she goes, uh-oh. And I'll do that in movies to troll her. And she does not love me as much because of
I'm seeing Nevada the Band the movie finally like next this on Wednesday, which I've been waiting for months, and it is at a very student but beautiful theater. And I can't wait to tell some dickhead students to shut the fuck up, because I feel like after the pandemic, people just don't fucking like, yeah, they just talk through shit. Fact. Like they're the main characters. I was at this thing, like a DJ thing yesterday, and people were chatting through that shit. And I was like, I'm trying to listen to the music, you cunt. Like, yeah. Mm. Talking
this DJ
and stuff.
Crafted a sick playlist just for us, and you're talking through it.
Exactly. they're doing shit you don't even fucking understand, and I'm trying to work it out. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to work out how they're sampling, working out how they're beat matching. But I can't fucking work it out because you're chatting your shit in ass for it. Like, shut the fuck up. Let me enjoy the music.
Look, they're trying to.
And I was at the front. I was right in front of them. Like, fucking cunts. Anyway, yeah, I hate people.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
I'm so sorry, Duncan.